Our next case is number 051371, Task Distributing Company, Incorporated, against Cummings Engine Company. Mr. Riffle.
Good morning. May it please the court, Ms. Holsall. I'm Bob Riffle, here today on behalf of Task Distributing Company. This case comes to the court on our appeal from the grant of a summary judgment which disposed of our case in its entirety. This case involves my client's patented proprietary technology that is valuable in the diesel engine industry. I'll get into the specifics later in my discussion, but just by way of background, my client developed two very valuable proprietary products. One is called Tempa Start, and the other is called Tempa Stop. The just in a nutshell, the Tempa Start technology is used, for instance, when a semi-truck driver drives into a rest area on a cold evening and wants to sleep for a while. He can turn on the Tempa Start feature, turn off the engine of his truck, and when certain parameters are met, such as ambient air temperature or oil temperature, the Tempa Start product will start the engine up to avoid the batteries going dead and avoid the cab getting too cold to be usable overnight. The Tempa Stop product stops an engine after it's idled for a particular period of time. And the one unique feature of my client's Tempa Stop product is that it not only turns off the engine, but it also turns off the electricity to the accessories.
You say your client's product. Does your client actually manufacture an item that is placed in engines, or does it simply have the proprietorship to the underlying technology?
My client in the past has manufactured a product, and it still does on a very limited basis manufacture some product. Primarily, it's in the business of licensing this technology. It originally licensed this technology to Detroit Diesel Corporation, which is a major engine manufacturer, and then subsequently it licensed the same technology to Cummins Engine Company. So two large companies have the rights primarily in what we call the one-box or ECM product to put it right on the engine, the electronics of the actual engine. My client still manufactures what we call a retrofit product, a product that can be wired into a truck and attached to the engine to do essentially the same functions.
But, you know, the history is kind of interesting here because your client, as you said, first licenses its technology to Detroit Diesel. And just reading what's before us anyway, it looks to me like it had roughly the same gripe with Detroit Diesel. It sues Detroit Diesel in 96, alleging that it had failed to meet the performance and payment criteria to maintain its exclusivity. Once the declaration, which eventually gets resolved, the Detroit Diesel lost its rights under the agreement. And I guess what it seems to me the heart of this case, the district judge agrees with you that under our RoboServe decision, a reasonable efforts clause is sufficiently clear and understandable. But the district judge, I think, sees it as just a failure of proof case on whether there are any damages to you from the alleged sort of anemic efforts that Cummins uses with this Icon product that it makes 200 of. And I would appreciate if you would address that, because it seems to me when you're getting testimony from your CEO that you think somebody else could have made 15,000 units, or you think that perhaps every engine manufactured with any kind of auto shutoff ought to have had your technology in it, that's awfully fuzzy.
Your Honor, two aspects of that. One, if I could draw a distinction between the lawsuit between TAS and Cummins and TAS and Detroit Diesel.
Okay.
The distinction, the primary thing that was alleged to be a shortcoming by Detroit Diesel was a payment default and a dispute as to interpretation of an agreement, a technical aspect of that. There was never an allegation that they had dismally failed to develop the product. The lawsuits were somewhat different. But
okay.
But going, I think, to the what is really the central issue in this case, did TAS adequately prove damages sufficient to survive summary judgment? We assert respectfully that we did, and that we did so in two distinct ways. The trial court, and keep in mind, please, that the trial court only addressed the Tempa start aspect of the case, never even addressed Tempa stop, which I'll get to in a moment. But we had two alternative theories, damages theories, as to why we were entitled to survive summary judgment and proceed to a jury trial on damages. One was Cummins' own projections, representations, and statements to TAS at the time they came to TAS and enticed TAS to do business with them.
But the district court thinks that that's really not evidence of what could have happened. It's a pre-contractual estimate. And instead of putting a minimum production obligation in the licensing agreement, you have this minimum royalty payment, which everybody agrees Cummins met, right?
Absolutely. The distinction there, I believe, Your Honor, is in the absence of any real effort by Cummins, we don't look to this 10 to 12,000 unit projection as an ironclad contractual obligation that they had to meet. Not at all. And the judge would have been correct if we had tried to use that as parole evidence to say that notwithstanding the fact that it's a all reasonable efforts clause and not a specific number, our argument isn't that they had this contractual obligation to sell 10 to 12,000 units. Our argument is, in the absence of these efforts, what do we look to determine how many they should have made? And what's the best evidence?
The best, that's what stopped me in analyzing your case. You gave two possible methods of computing that, but it's the one that you didn't ask the court to take a look at, well, how many other engines Cummins in fact manufactured during that period but never used your technology in. Apparently Cummins made many other engines. When it didn't put its Icon product in those engines, it apparently, and here the record is very fuzzy, but they apparently continued to use a product that they had developed prior to all of these negotiations and never used your product. Why isn't that the appropriate measure of damages?
With respect to the Tempa Stop product, Your Honor, that's exactly our claim. There are two different systems, one of which they used a different product, this idle shutdown, one of which they didn't use any technology. As to Tempa Start, they essentially abandoned our product, put it on the shelf, and didn't have any system that would start up an engine in the example I gave of the rest area where the truck driver needed the truck to start during the middle of the night.
With respect to Tempa Start, we know how many engines Cummins made.
Correct.
Why isn't that the appropriate measure of damages?
Because we don't believe that Cummins had an obligation to put Tempa Start on every single engine
made. Why is that?
Because based on their projections, they said that they would sell 10 to 12,000 of these. I believe at any given time they sold 30 to 90,000 engines, but not every single engine. For instance, they sell some engines in the southern part of the United States where the cold weather start at a rest area isn't as crucial. So we didn't ever expect 100% market share on the Tempa Start product, whereas because every electronic engine needs a shutdown feature, we do expect them to have that on every engine for the Tempa Stop product.
So let's look at the Tempa Stop product. They made a very large number of engines and did not use the Tempa Stop technology, right?
That's correct.
And on those engines, what did they use?
They used a feature called idle shutdown, which does everything that Tempa Stop does except for one thing. Idle shutdown does not shut the electricity off
right.
to the accessories. Tempest Stop does, and that's the enhanced feature that my client has to avoid the batteries going down.
They had that technology before their license agreement with you, is that correct?
I believe that's probably correct, that they had the idle shutdown before they licensed Tempest Stop.
And they didn't change and use your technology afterwards, is that correct?
That is correct.
Why isn't that then the appropriate measure of damages with respect to the Tempest Stop?
That is. That is indeed, Your Honor.
Is that what you've argued?
Yes, Your Honor.
But what I don't understand, they respond that the idle shutdown was simply a built-in feature of the engine itself. It wasn't like a gizmo that goes into the engine somehow. Maybe I'm not being technical enough, but I'm obviously not an engineer. And that there was a price issue that they would have had to pay, a certain licensing fee and other additional amount, had they changed over to Tempest Stop. And so I guess the issue is, just because people will take something for free doesn't necessarily mean they'll pay for it.
And I think, Your Honor, our response to that is, they came to us, we had a patent for Tempest Stop, they licensed it. If you look at the series of definitions that we have at page 4 and 5 of our brief, it is subject technology. They had an obligation to put our subject technology into products, and I quote, make all reasonable efforts to market and sell ECM products and retrofit products so as to maximize the payment of royalties to licensor under this license agreement.
What about their argument that putting it in would interfere with various environmental kinds of equipment that needed to be in there?
Well, I think that's somewhat of a red herring from our perspective. They had it in the ECM at one point in time. Then they changed their ECM to basically comply with a set of regulations that had been around for years and years. Detroit Diesel had to face those same requirements and maintain their product in the ECM. But even if for some reason temporarily they had to take it out of the ECM, why didn't they develop a separate product? Or why didn't they continue to engineer to put it back in? What they did at that point was they took our product, they put it on the shelf, and there it sits. And how can that possibly comply with their all reasonable efforts clause? They said they're going to sell 10,000 to 12,000 a year. They sell 200. It's a very large company with very large resources. And what they've done is really turned their back on a small company. They came to TAS, not the other way around. They solicited TAS. They said that this is what they could do. And now, when asked to honor their commitment, they turn around and say, no, you can't rely upon those at all. And they come back to this minimum royalty payment as though that is their entire obligation. Well, they're trying to read the all reasonable efforts clause entirely out. We can write you a million-dollar check, which is a drop in the bucket compared to the cost of developing this technology,
sure,
and simply turn our back. If we ever need it, we have it tied up, but...
But wouldn't you have needed to show that the damage, that they would have manufactured enough of these products that the royalty due would have exceeded the million?
Yes, and again, our damages theory.
A bunch of different theory. I mean, I realize you come up with different numbers, 3 million, 6 million, et cetera.
Right, and we think that under the Illinois law, we should have been allowed to present those calculations to the jury. The case law is clear. The evidence need only to tend to show a basis for computation with a fair degree of probability. The cases we cite at page 37 and 38 of our brief, lost profits don't need to be proven with absolute certainty. Such damages are not capable of proof with absolute certainty, and thus we merely require the evidence to tend to establish a basis for the assessment of damages. It's a jury question as to whether we're right or wrong. We should have been allowed, I believe, to go to the jury and say, Cummins says they could have sold $10,000 to $12,000. They actually sold $200,000. We believe that, given their capability and assessment of the market, that ought to be given some credence to the extent that they have.
Do say that you have to show a reasonable basis for computation.
Yes.
You offered two.
Yes.
And those are the only two we're to consider then. Is that right?
Well, we offered two theories on Tempest Start. That would be the 10 to 12,000 units that were projected by Cummins and the 15,000 that were sold by Detroit Diesel. But then as to Tempest Stop, which you were asking about earlier, our alternate theory on Tempest Stop is that on every single electronic engine that they manufactured and put idle shutdown on, they should have put Tempest Stop on. So we really have two monetary damages theories on Tempest Start, and then the one damages theory on Tempest Stop, all of which we respectfully suggest should have been allowed to go to the jury.
Thank you, Mr. Riffle.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Ms. Holtzall.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Not every dispute between a large company and a small company is a David and Goliath situation. Regardless of the size of a plaintiff or its financial strength, it still must prove every element of its case. In this case, the district court correctly found that there was a failure of proof on the part of TAS to show that it had been damaged by anything Cummins did or did not do in the marketing of its idle management technology. As an initial matter, I'd like to point out that it was not until appellant's reply brief that they argued that damages aren't a measure, aren't an element of a claim for breach of contract. That's contrary to Illinois law. We have submitted supplemental authority to establish that, and I believe that if I understand Mr. Riffle's argument correctly, they're no longer pursuing that. The fact remains is that TAS presented no evidence that had Cummins done anything differently, had Cummins done everything that Detroit Diesel did in marketing its idle management technology, that royalties would have exceeded $1 million.
Did Cummins have some sort of an exclusivity agreement? I know the litigation with Detroit Diesel was to, I guess, establish that they didn't have an exclusive agreement. What about Cummins?
The license ultimately signed between Cummins and TAS gave Cummins non-exclusive rights to the technology. It expressly permitted TAS to continue to license the technology to Detroit Diesel, to license it to Mack, under certain circumstances, to license the technology to Caterpillar, basically covering all the major engine manufacturers in the country.
But you know, there's an interesting footnote in the district court's opinion that appears on page 12 of its opinion, which also is page A12, where the court's saying, accordingly, Cummins would have had to sell in excess of 2,000 units to exceed its minimum royalty obligations. But then at the bottom of that page, that's not where the footnote signal is, but at the bottom of the page, the court notes that Cummins has submitted a document suggesting in 2001 Detroit Diesel, he uses the word only, Detroit Diesel sold 4,883 units. In 2000, it sold 6,516. What struck me about that footnote is both of those numbers are well in excess of 2,000 units. And so even if Cummins had only matched what another comparable company in the market was doing, it would have been paying more than the minimum royalty.
The disconnect between Detroit Diesel and Cummins is due to the fact that Detroit Diesel was TAS's exclusive licensee for several years before Cummins was ever granted a license. What there is no competent evidence showing that Detroit Diesel and Cummins, with respect to these idle management products for particular types of trucks, are in fact comparable. There was no evidence of what Detroit Diesel has done. Mr. Slepian, who's...
Well, except this footnote. I mean, this is apparently a document you gave the court. Cummins has submitted the document showing the 4,883 and 6,516. Now, I take your point that maybe we don't know whether those units are comparable to units that Cummins sold, but it's just a curious statement here when something in excess of 2,000 units, it seems to be the magic number.
It may be the magic number for Detroit Diesel, which was already well entrenched.
No, but for you, he says Cummins would have had to sell in excess of 2,000 units to exceed its minimum royalty obligations. And then we're just in a numbers game, which would be for a jury, I would suppose, to
correct,
resolve.
But there are other failures. There's no showing that Detroit Diesel had not already saturated the market. There is no showing that Detroit Diesel and Cummins' marketing efforts weren't comparable or identical. if Cummins was doing everything Detroit Diesel was doing, then there's no causation. The difference cannot be attributed to Cummins' efforts, which is required to exercise under the contract. There was just not enough to put together to get to a jury. TAS simply picked 15,000 units because that's what Detroit Diesel sold without any predicate facts showing that Detroit Diesel sales, Detroit Diesel's products, and Cummins sales and Cummins products were otherwise comparable.
Well, this is the 15,000 number that comes from the TAS CEO, is that right?
That's correct, his affidavit.
That you've criticized anyway as
Correct. He had testified in his deposition that he had no idea how many sales they'd really made.
Right. So I take it you're not accepting that number as an accurate reflection of what Detroit Diesel is doing.
No. In fact, the document was submitted to the district court to show that there's no evidence, no competent evidence, of what Detroit Diesel sales were. There was the 15,000 figure. No one knows where Mr. Slepian got that figure. There was this document showing something else. Even in its briefs before this court, TAS has said, we're not really sure how many units Detroit Diesel sold, but we'll come up with it if this ever goes to trial.
But what about the numbers that Mr. Riffle was discussing earlier, namely the number of engines Cummins manufactures with idle shutdown capability? It's really a question of engine design, whether something is somehow deeply integrated into the engine or whether it's sort of a discernible extra part or something. I'm not sure that how it's done matters as much. And it's certainly a question of corporate marketing, whether you just sell an engine for a package price and you don't charge separately for an idle shutdown feature, or whether you do charge separately. So I'm not sure that either of those distinguishes it.
I'd like to clear up a few misconceptions with the so-called Tempestop product. First of all, TAS has not pointed to any language in the agreement that requires Cummins to develop, manufacture, and market a Tempestop product that's separate from the Tempestart or full idle management package. It's undisputed that these Tempestop features were included in Cummins' ICOM product, which was, you know, both a stop-start functionality. The fact remains is that no one...
I think they do dispute that. Do you think that's a question of the interpretation of the license agreement? Because they read the license agreement to say, here are these various listed products covered, and the best efforts obligation goes to all of them and to each of them individually, is the way they're reading it. And you're saying, well, no, I mean, any you're allowed the discretion to pick and choose any way you want.
Not necessarily. When the agreement was amended, it changed the terminology. The retrofit product became a Tempestart two-box product. The ECM product became a Tempestart one-box product. Then there was this third category, the Tempestop system, or a license to the Tempestop patent. Well, in order to manufacture, develop and manufacture and sell the Tempestart system as defined by the agreement, you need that patent. You need the Tempestop patent. So Cummins was using that technology in conjunction with its full ICON start-stop technology package. With respect to idle shutdown, that has been used by every manufacturer since well before TAS ever entered on the scene. It is just a function of the engine. It's like the ignition. It's different from Tempestop. There's been no show. No one makes Tempestop. TAS doesn't manufacture one. Detroit Diesel doesn't manufacture Tempestop, even though it paid $100 for the rights to do so. There's been no showing that anyone purchases it on a retrofit basis. There's no showing that there is a market for it, that people will pay money, you know, perhaps a few hundred dollars at the minimum, to get something that they can get for free. And you made that point, Judge Wood. It was incumbent upon TAS, as the plaintiff, with the burden of proof, not just to throw theories out, to say, maybe somebody will buy this, but to support it with evidence, market studies, an expert coming in and saying, we've analyzed the market, it shows that we've taken surveys, we've determined that this market segment wants this technology. There was none of that. All it was a theory unsupported by any predicate facts.
The Tempus start that Cummins, there were some that they used and put in product, right? In
the yes. Both the Tempus, the start function and the stop function was incorporated in Cummins' idle management product, which is known as ICON. And they sold that. They are continuing to sell it.
Is it with TASS's technology?
Yes, yes. And they've paid royalties. Unfortunately, the royalties have not approached the minimum royalty that Cummins has paid.
Well, so the other question I have is, as far as TASS is concerned, is do they have a prototype? He said that they sell or manufacture a few of them, some number. Is there a prototype that is sort of a turnkey for whatever you have to, whatever Cummins would have to use, or does it have to be modified significantly in order to go into a Cummins engine?
That's a very good question. It has to be not only modified to go into a Cummins engine. For instance, it would be different for a Cummins engine than for a Detroit diesel engine than for a Volvo engine. Not only does it have to be engineered specifically to the engine, it has to be engineered specifically for the vehicle OEM. So if a Cummins engine is going to go into a Freightliner truck or an international truck, they have to be wired differently. So it's specific not only to the engine manufacturer, but to the ultimate truck manufacturer. So there was significant development that had to go into the product. It just isn't interchangeable for everyone's engine. And Cummins did do that engineering. It managed to convince OEMs, yeah, this is a product you should look at. You should engineer it into your trucks. You should make the wiring necessary. Cummins did that. One aspect I'd like to clear up from Mr. Riffle's argument is he had mentioned Cummins pulling the ECM product to comply with EPA regulations that had been around for years and years. That's incorrect. Cummins had to redesign its engines completely, its ECM completely, to meet EPA regulations that became effective in October 2002 because of a consent decree with the Environmental Protection Agency. It wasn't as though these same regulations had been around for years. These were new.
Was that consent decree for Cummins only?
No, it was Cummins and other large engine manufacturers. Okay. These had not been around for years and years. In fact, they were very extremely stringent regulations, and Cummins had to completely re-engineer its ECM. What Cummins did do was continue to make the two-box product available. Two-box product actually carries a higher royalty than the integrated or one-box product, and they put extra resources to make sure that that was available when these regulations went into effect. So the product was available at all times.
Well, who makes the decision? You say it's available. Is this the purchaser that decides whether or not they want it?
Yes, yes. The ultimate, whether it's a fleet, whether it's an individual truck driver who says, I want this feature because I sleep in truck stops, or a fleet might want it, because we want to save on fuel economy. Another purchaser may say, I drive in the south, I don't want it. I spend a lot of time in California where there are very stringent emissions regulations. I have no use for it. So it is an option that's made available through the OEMs. The advertising, the sales are made to the fleets. But the decision is ultimately up to the consumer whether they want this product, because it does affect engine performance.
So your explanation for the reason that only 200 of these ICON products were sold is simply that there was not the market demand out there for them?
No. The thing is that the plaintiff never presented any evidence showing there was market demand, or taking into account things like the sales cycle, that engines are ordered well in advance of ultimate payment for the product, that you have to go out, you have to pitch to the ultimate consumer, you have to pitch to the OEMs. None of that was taken into account. All the plaintiff did was pick a number out of the air and say you should have sold this, without analyzing whether Cummins could have sold those. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Holtzall. You have 1 minute, Mr. Riffle.
I want to hit upon a couple of issues very briefly. There is exclusivity in this agreement. The world of engine manufacturers were divvied up at page 25 of the appendix, the First Amendment to the agreement, section A3 addresses that exclusivity. The idea that we pulled these numbers out of the air is disingenuous from our perspective. The number we utilized, the two different numbers we utilized, one is what Cummins told us they were going to sell, 10,000 to 12,000 units, not a number pulled out of the air, not an arbitrary number, but a number told by us, a small company.
Units of what?
Units of Tempa Start in our Tempa Start calculation. They were going to sell 10,000 to 12,000 of these units, according to their...
And how many did they tell you they'd sell at the Tempa Stop?
There was no discussion specific as to Tempa Stop.
No discussion.
That's correct. But they licensed
it. In the industry, everybody had an engine idle anyway, right?
But we had this patented technology that they came to us and licensed. It's a patented product, and the definitions make it clear that they had an affirmative obligation to make all reasonable efforts to develop, market, and sell our product. They didn't develop, market, and sell our product. The record is absolutely clear because...
I guess their point is they develop, market, and sell your product according to what market demand would permit, and you did not show anything to the contrary.
Well, with all due respect, I think that's not correct from the record. The reason we didn't brief extensively...
Right, see, with both briefs, a very difficult time with the record. The statement of facts in both briefs here is totally inadequate. I've spent a tremendous amount of time trying to get the facts straight. What does the, in your view, it show?
Well, the record, Your Honor, because the trial court ruled in our favor that we had enough evidence to survive summary judgment on whether their efforts were adequate. We didn't brief that as extensively as the other issues, but we went through the deposition testimony of their key people to show they made virtually no effort. These 200 units per year they're selling are just a matter of happenstance. It's on the shelf if somebody comes to them. The evidence is clear they've made no marketing effort in the last several years to go out and actually market this product. The evidence shows an absence of any marketing effort other than in the first year. The district court judge ruled in our favor on that. We had enough evidence to show to survive summary judgment that we were okay on that issue. We only got to the damages. So to the extent the question arises as to us showing that they didn't meet the all reasonable efforts clause, we already survived that for summary judgment. It really wasn't an issue, at least the key issue that we thought was to be addressed on appeal.
When you say other than the first year, suppose in that first year they found out that just isn't any market to speak of. Would they still be obligated to keep going when they've already used reasonable efforts that have proved not fruitful?
Well, we would not concede that even in the first year they made all reasonable efforts. Okay. They at least put some brochures together. After the first year, they didn't even have a brochure to take to trade shows. They were just using the antiquated brochures that they put together that didn't even show the development of the product over time.
Thank you, Mr. Riffle. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.